So first, I'd like to welcome all of you and just introduce myself just briefly. My name is Kali Okuno. I'm the acting co-director of the U.S. Human Rights Network. I'd like to thank you all for joining us and taking out some time to engage in this conversation with us. But before we start, we'd be remiss to not remind everyone that today is International Women's Day, and we encourage everyone to be in some active solidarity with some of the pressing struggles that are taking place around women's rights, particularly reproductive rights. We know we're seeing some aggressive assaults against women's reproductive rights here in Georgia and also in Virginia, and it is also kind of a recent victory that just took place in Florida, and folks can read all about that at our website, www.ushrnetwork.org. So definitely check that out, and also look for some of the various statements, including our own, about International Women's Day on the website as well, and we'll be emailing out to everyone a copy of that statement who is on our listserv. So just wanted to take note of that. Today's session is connecting the dots again, the Occupy movement and the struggle for economic, social, and cultural rights. And we're really just trying to make some links and expose some links around the economic, social, and cultural rights framework and how Occupy is really kind of helping to bring some of the critical issues around inequity, retrenchment, immiseration of large sectors of the population, neoliberalism, capitalism itself, to the forefront of conversation and policy discussion and struggle within this country. So we really just want to highlight some of that today. But just to give, for those of you who are not necessarily familiar with the ESCR, the Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights Framework, just wanted to highlight, not in depth, but just a couple of key points that the International Covenant on Internet on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights covers. And again, this is not the covenant itself should not be taken to be the full encompassing scope of what economic, social, and cultural rights are. We always have to remember that, you know, human rights is an expanded field, and it's expanded through social struggle that all of us are engaged in one form or another here in the United States. So just to give a small sampling of some of those that are within that the covenant, there's the right to work and the rights at work, and we should be mindful that right to work within this framework does not have the same connotation that it does in the United States, which most people, I think, aptly propose the legislation here in the United States means the right to work for less, as it kind of really strips workers and the working class from being able to organize in their own name in a collective fashion. But within the UN framework, what it entails is the right to join unions and the right to collective labor action, and then there's rights at work, which include health, safety, things of that nature. There's a right to Social Security, and all that entails, including, you know, care for the youth and care for the elderly, care for those who have various disabilities. That's a key part of it. There's the right to rest and to leisure. There's the right to an adequate standard of living. There's a right to health and health care, right to food, the right to water, to adequate housing, to education, and the rights to the benefits of science and culture. So when you really think about that in its accompanying fashion, those are a lot of the different things that Occupy, as it's kind of burst on the scene, has really brought to the forefront in terms of social consciousness as issues that really need to be struggled around. So we wanted to really highlight how these things connect and some of the work that folks are engaged in within the membership and beyond it, and really looking forward to, you know, some of the social activities that are being called for in 2012 that some of us are organizing, some of us on this call that you'll be hearing from our three presenters, and then we'll just get into discussion. So to participate in the discussion, when we get to that point, we're going to listen to the speakers first, and then we'll get into a kind of open question and answer session. To get in the queue for that session, what you want to do is press star 1, and I'll repeat that and as we go along, but you want to press star 1 to get in that queue, and the queue will be answered, you know, in numeric order. So first one up, first one to be answered. So, again, that's star 1. So today we have with us, and this will just be some brief introductions. You can find some more biographical material in the email or on our website, is Monica Adams with Take Back to Land Madison, and also Operation Welcome Home in Madison. We have Marianne Work with the Black Orchid Collective in Seattle. And we have Saladin Muhammad with Black Workers for Justice in North Carolina. So I am going to start with Monica, then we'll go with we'll go in that order, then we'll have Marianne, and then we'll close out with Saladin. So, Monica, you with us?
Yes. Is this fine, this volume?
You're on. It's your show. Take it away.
So, as Kali just mentioned, I'm with Take Back the Land. I'm an organizer at the local level with Take Back the Land Madison, as well as part of the National Leadership Corps. And so Take Back the Land is a movement whose objective is to fundamentally transform land relations in this country. And so what we mean by that is currently land is either owned by a private person or corporation or some sort of entity, or either owned in a public sense, like parks and different things like that. And we think that land should be decommodified, and so our work is really about decommodifying land, and that we believe that the community should control the land. And so the movement has four main objectives. So one of them, as I mentioned, is to get community control over land. The second is to elevate housing as a human right, meaning housing as a fundamental right. Also, we think that those most impacted by the housing crisis and other oppressions that infringe on people's rights should be the ones leading the movement. And so what that looks like here in the United States, those that tend to be most impacted by the current crises are low-income women of color, and particularly Black women, and also LGBTQ folks of color. And we also think that in the movement, it needs to be strongly led by what we call positive action, which is direct action or nonviolent civil disobedience work. And the way that we do our work is we do what is called liberation, and we also do what we call defenses. And so we identify houses that are currently owned by banks who received the federal bailout money, and we bust into those houses. We move homeless people into them, so we pair people's houses with homeless people, and we kick out the banks. We get the banks out of the house. We believe that the community should be the ones who are controlling what happens, and it makes no sense for there to be all of these empty homes and all these homeless people. So it's really not a housing crisis, because there are more than enough houses. It's really a human rights crisis that we're facing. And so we believe, so embedded deeply in our work is the right, like cultural rights and other socioeconomic rights. So rights that often, I think, get left out around race and class and gender, sexuality, ability, language, citizenship status, immigration status. So we very much built those into our work. And so what we are seeing here is that the climate right now that people are describing is particularly unique, because it's impacting a particular group or a particular sect of people that were not impacted maybe 20 years ago, and that group being white, middle-class folks. And so it's the same, if you will, it's the same structural issues that are impacting white, middle-class people as it is impacting low-income people of color, but it's presenting very differently. And so what we've seen in our work of liberating homes is that work is very, very effective, and that work is very, very meaningful for people who are living in low-income communities of color, but it may not be the most effective work for people to do who are not those people. So what we're proposing, so Take Back the Land has been around since 2006, doing that very strong liberation and defense work. What we're proposing for the spring is something called a spring action. And so that is going to be a very strong collaboration, a very strong partnership between organizations who have been organizing around the economic crisis. And so it'll be Take Back the Land and also some groups who were involved who are involved in the Occupy movement, as well as groups who are involved in the December 6th actions. And what that really looks like and what we really think we need to do is surround the banks. And what we mean by that is we need to be taking back houses, we need to be taking back land that are owned by the banks, as well as putting direct pressure on the banks to shut down or to make policy changes. And so hello? I was weird. Can folks still hear me?
Yeah, I think we lost you just for a quick second, Madam Book, but everybody's still here. They're all on mute except for myself.
Okay, I don't know what just happened. That was weird. Okay, and so the way that will work is that there will be trainings offered for folks who are interested in doing liberation work and in identifying the houses that are owned by these banks that receive the money and moving people into those houses, as well as there will be trainings and support given to folks who want to do more actions that target the banks directly, whether it be going into banks and protesting, organizing campaigns such as folks who withdraw money and shutting down banks and all different sorts of creative things. And we think that if this is done, if that a lot of people engage in this, if there's a mass or if there's a national mobilization around it, we think that this will create the kind of leverage that we need to not only demand that banks change policies, but that we actually get property turned over to the community. And we've seen in different places throughout the country where we've been very, very close to winning houses outright, so really setting a high bar for what we can win in this country. Right now in Rochester, there's a local action group, Take Back the Land Rochester, who is very, very close to winning the house outright from the bank. And what this would look like is the bank would not give the house to the group, Take Back the Land Rochester, or even to the particular person, Catherine Lennon, who's living there, but instead the bank will turn over the land to the community. And right now that alternative structure, that community structure, is a land trust, and we are still working out what some more alternative structures could look like. But that's really where we are focusing. And I think the strength as related to the ESCR framework, as well as it being like the International Women's Day, is that the leaders, and what we're seeing, the leaders of the people who are doing a lot of the organizing of this work are low-income women of color. If folks are interested, they can check out our website, takebacktheland.org, and you'll see a list of different local action groups throughout the country. And the folks who are fighting the fights in the houses, the folks who are doing a lot of the grassroots organizing, the work on the ground, are low-income black women and other women of color. And so we think that is really important in this current debate and in building this movement, that the movement be inclusive of all different identities, of all different experiences and all different histories. And we think that the way that you have to do it is to continuously be talking about land here, land relations, because we really think land is what drives class, or land is class in this country. And we see the huge disparities for land control and land ownership between the different identity groups.
Yeah. All right. Thank you for that, Monica. Up next, we have Mary Ann. Mary Ann, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right. So it's on you.
All right. I just want to say thank you so much for organizing this call. We're really honored and excited to be talking with you all. The Black Orchid Collective is a very, very small group of people. We're a young group, only a year and a half old. Our tagline is open to ruptures and emergences, and I wanted to encourage people to check out our blog. We have a very active blog. It's blackorchidcollective.wordpress.com. Please check it out, read, comment. I'm going to be referencing a piece, pretty long piece that we published about a month ago. It's called Longview, Occupy, and Beyond, Rank and File, and the 89% Unite. We wrote it in collaboration with Portland and Oakland comrades. I'm also going to be referencing Longview, Washington, and I just wanted to give some context in case people haven't followed this story much. So Longview is a small port town of 37,000 on the border between Oregon and Washington. About 2 years ago, EGT, a multinational grain conglomerate, got a special state tax exemption in a sweetheart lease deal from the Port of Longview to build a $200 million grain terminal. And they began, EGT began running the project on cheap and tried to hire non-ILWU workers to work the terminal. And this would effectively break the ILWU's control of the West Coast ports. So the Longview workers built a 24-hour picket line in front of the terminal. They physically stopped scabs from entering, and nearly every member of their local has been arrested at least once. And a train container full of grain was mysteriously dumped a few months later. So during the fall, they connected up with the Occupy movement and West Coast activists up and down through Oakland and Portland and Seattle, prepared to mobilize hundreds of people to Longview to blockade an EGT grain ship. And within a week of the expected ship arrival, the state governor, EGT, and the union leader sat down and settled a contract in which says that ILWU can work in the grain terminal. So that's just kind of context on that situation. So Black Orchid Collective has a track record of labor organizing. We've been involved with janitors at the University of Washington, non-unionized nursing home workers, University of Washington grad student workers. In the fall, when Occupy hit Seattle, we really dove in. We helped build a crew of militants across tendencies. We created a radical pole in Seattle that was anti-fascist, anti-police, that promoted a diversity of tactics. It overlapped largely with the People of Color Caucus and the Decolonize Occupy Seattle groupings. So in Seattle, we had many, many street confrontations that created a pretty large shift with a lot of the moderate and liberal-leaning people. In Seattle, they were maced in the face, and all of a sudden they were kind of coming to different conclusions about the police. Initially, they were saying the police are part of the 99%, and then they started to say that the police protect the 1%. So I want to fast forward November 2nd in Occupy Oakland. They organized what they called a general strike. Tens of thousands of people came out and shut down the Port of Oakland. And at the end of November, a few weeks later, the Oakland again called for a West Coast port shutdown for December 12th. And I'm sorry if this is repetitive for anyone who's kind of already familiar with the situation. I just want to give context. So this port shutdown, the reasons for it was to retaliate against the coordinated police crackdown on the Occupy movement, to confront Wall Street on the waterfront, to be in solidarity with Los Angeles port truckers, and to be in solidarity with Longview port workers. So this gave us a little over 2 weeks to prepare to shut down terminals at the Port of Seattle. Myself, I'm born and raised in Seattle, and I've spent like less than a minute down there before December 12th. It was a huge learning curve for us. The day of December 12th, over 1,000 people in Seattle marched over 4 miles to the Port of Seattle. We shut down the largest terminal with a hard barricade. It was about the size of a small bus made with railroad and other industrial materials. When this terminal was confirmed to be shut down, we marched a mile further and shut down the second largest terminal with a traditional circular labor picket with a hip-hop cipher in the middle. There's really kind of this image or vision for the years ahead. There were coordinated high school walkouts and one of the largest turnouts of youth of color in an Occupy Seattle action. If you go to the Black Orchid blog, there's a high school student's YouTube video that they made that's really inspiring. So it wasn't just Seattle. There were shutdowns in Oakland and Portland. There was actions all up and down the West Coast, all the way to Alaska, over to Texas. People had actions at Walmart in the Midwest. So in building for the port shutdown, some of it were objective factors that allowed it to happen, be successful, and some of it were related to our practice. And I want to focus on our practice because that's kind of what we can change and what I'd like to hear people on this call their ideas about. So we were able to build the port shutdown because we were surrounded by this radical grouping of dope militants who were multi-tenancy, who had built trust together working around the Occupy camp. We were working with a small group of longshore workers who courageously went against their bureaucracy to work with us. And then there was just a general positive vibe among the radical left in Seattle. There was also insurrectionists who were really important to making the barricade happen. So there's been a lot of writings what happened day of, and I would encourage you to go check them out online. So as far as what Black Orchid did as an organization, how we contributed and shaped the Seattle situation, we think that the political content in Seattle was actually much more substantial than what happened that was coming out of Oakland, even though they originated the port shutdown. So we put out a piece that was called Why We Shut Down the Ports in Seattle, and the messaging included the Longview struggle, but really highlighted that this action, the shutdown, was to build class confidence and power, working class confidence and power. We said we will shut down the ports, we'll blockade capital to cut the profits of the 1%. We said everything for everyone, the ports belong to everyone, this land is not private. What goes through the ports belongs to everyone. And we said we're against austerity measures and against budget cuts. So we really didn't focus heavily on Longview or our local ILWU, Local 19. And this piece spread very quickly. The language in it was taken up by a lot of different groups. So in Seattle, our objective conditions really made us learn quickly. We didn't have a friendly ILWU local. Like in Oakland, it's a majority Black local. They have done actions to support Free Mumia. They've shut down the port in solidarity with actions for justice for Oscar Grant. In Seattle, it's a majority white, very conservative local. They're Local 19 in Seattle. They put out statements to the press that they were against the shutdown. No labor unions in the Northwest would touch this action, using the excuse that it would be stepping on ILWU turf. The ISO, Trotsky groups, and other labor groups told us we were going about this the wrong way. We needed first to appeal to labor with a capital L to make this successful. So what this led us to do was to make it explicit that we need to challenge labor law, that labor law is the law of the 1%, which is the bedrock of union and labor bureaucracy. December 12th showed that the dispossessed, the proletariat, can only use barricades to blockade capital. The language that we put out, we said, 89% of workers are non-unionized, and this provided subjectivity for casualized workers, people who are, underpaid, underemployed, imprisoned, not employed, so forth. For example, we did a speaking tour after the shutdown, and we had a working-class Black militant who's been doing workplace organizing as a barista come and speak, and we had a Chicana economic refugee talk about farm worker struggle and the connection to the port. So we were very persistent to say that this is not that the action on December 12th was not just to support unionized workers, but was this opportunity to bring together different layers of the class. So we really put a lot of thought into what this unity looks like in terms of strategy and tactics of actions. I think it was represented in our picket line, having a hip-hop cipher in addition to, the traditional circular picket line. And also in the social spaces and the composition of our organizing, the culture of our organizing, it's really important to be aware of what layers of the class we are working with. And so we were attacked a lot during the organizing for the December 12th port shutdown from many different sides. And I think it really shows that we struck a nerve with the kind of old school labor movement. So I think that's the first thing we did. We did a lot of political content. Another thing we did is we built with port truckers. So a little bit of context: in Seattle, there's about 2,000 short haul truckers at the Port of Seattle. They haul containers from the ships to the warehouses. Over a third of them in Seattle are East African immigrants. Another third are Russian immigrants, and the remaining third are Southeast Asian, Sikh, Black American, and white. It's a much different layer of the class than like the ILWU Local 19, which is majority white. I'm kind of the aristocracy of the working class. So these port truckers are non-unionized. They're paid per load. They pay for gas, truck maintenance, licensing, fines. They work 6 days a week, 11-hour days. They get paid at most $20,000 to $25,000 a year. They're mistreated by company managers and other port workers. They're called racist names, ridiculed for having accents. And if they speak back, they face severe retaliation. They get fired or they don't get work. So the issue is that they're classified as independent contractors, and they work for middlemen companies who distribute the work from the shipping corporations. So recently, mostly East African truckers formed an association. There's also a handful of Sikhs and Russians involved. And it's mostly truckers from larger companies. So the Teamsters are also involved in this. The Teamsters are helping push legislation to reclassify them as employees so that they can unionize. Seattle port truckers, a few weeks after the December 12th port shutdown, went on a two-week strike, which was huge. And leading up to the port shutdown, we had flyered port truckers every single morning at 6 a.m., and we were really intentional about building connections with them that we followed up on later. They actually contacted us to attend their meetings, and the problem was that our level of engagement was really limited by the Teamsters and by our own lack of resources, being pretty burnt out. So all of the truckers knew about the port shutdown, and we think it contributed to their confidence and their confidence in going on strike, taking action. And it was actually during a port shutdown mass meeting that kind of inspired the port truckers to announce themselves as an association. So after the port shutdown, like I said, most of us were burnt out and we were unable to really deeply engage in the port trucker struggle. I have a couple other points that I want to bring out, and then I don't know if I'll have time, but talk about farm worker organizing we've been doing as well. So another thing that came out of this organizing was that this polarization of the debates about labor bureaucracy and what our role as the grassroots revolutionaries are in relation to labor bureaucracy and not tailing them, not following behind. So we came to the conclusion that union bureaucrats, regardless of how progressive individual labor leaders are, their positions rest largely in their ability to adhere to the contract, which they've negotiated with capitalists. And so this is kind of speaking to the dual nature of unions, of NL, of national labor relations unions, that workers can use the structure to make gains, but they're limited by contracts or labor law. Those kind of, it's a dual nature, we really saw that coming into play. We also were clear that we weren't going to be shock troops for the unions, taking illegal actions that they needed to take or wanted to take to make gains, but wouldn't take because they feared fines. Instead, we pushed that we are part of a new subjectivity emerging that is of non-unionized workers, the unemployed, the dispossessed. And there was a lot of the reaction was a fear of this new identity and subjectivity because it threatens the monopoly that union bureaucracies have over all labor. We captured the subjectivity through the language of the 89%, which is problematic. We see, you know, that it can be seen as populist or that it's inclusive of elements of the class that we are not, you know, the petite bourgeoisie and so forth. So it's problematic, but it starts a way of asking the honest questions about unions, the unemployed, who is the working class, who has historically pretended to represent the working class, and what we as a class could do. Our organizing is majority women of color, working class people. All of us have done service, a lot of us have done service work, caring labor, if we're even employed. And so this is not considered hardcore labor, and I think that really speaks to why this language of the 89% was so appealing. And another thing that we did is we challenged territorialism. The ports are a male space. It's majority men who work there. And we really challenged the territorialism of the ILWU, the crusty kind of union structure that divides the working class. And when we were doing this, when we were making these arguments, we had an audience, which was the most important thing. We critiqued unions from the left. We're not anti-union, but we are critical of unions. And and how the way that the NLRB unions reproduce divisions within the working class, you know, like farm workers and domestic workers are not allowed to unionize, and that's a very racialized aspect of the NLRB. And so we were able to talk about these things in a mass way, which was important. So I can talk a little bit about the farm workers. We were contacted by dairy farm workers in Eastern Washington who've been organizing with the UFW for a couple years. They face low wages, long hours, abusive boss who carries a shotgun around the farm, and threats of ICE and so forth. And so dozens of workers, many undocumented, were fired for suspicion of unionizing. And we organized an action we went over to Eastern Washington and visited them, talked with them, and then we organized an action in the Dairy Gold headquarters in Seattle, and they were able to deliver their petitions. It was a moment of this kind of class unity where port workers that we had worked with from the port shutdown came and spoke about the need for solidarity between farm workers and between port workers, unionized port workers. And we had Occupy activists who forced open the doors of the Dairy Gold headquarters so that a farm worker's son could deliver petitions. And there's just this, again, this moment where the different layers of the class, we could, our tactics reflected this need for unity. So I guess I'll put forth a couple of questions. So some questions that we have been struggling with is, how do we navigate the dual nature of NLRB unions? We often get labeled as anti-union, but what we want to do is we want to imagine new mass class struggle, new mass class struggle organization that faces the forces of contradictions, and that, how do we build independent workplace groups? Where are they currently happening? And how does this connect in with the work that Take Back the Land is doing? So we welcome more questions. I welcome more questions, welcome critical feedback. Really excited to be on this call. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Marianne. Next, we have Saladin. And as folks are thinking about the question and answer session and make comments, again, you want to press star 1 to get in the queue. And I'll repeat it one last time after Saladin. But Saladin, you there?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Greetings, everyone. I'm very glad to hear the presentations. I'm a member of the Black Workers for Justice, and located in North Carolina and in Virginia, in the main, but, you know, some members in a few other places. Our members are active rank-and-file members, as well as organizers in the labor movement and other social movements of the working class, especially the Black working class in North Carolina and Virginia, aligned with others throughout the South. Our concentration has really been in the South, as we feel, and I think history bears out, that this is a strategic region in the struggle, not only against U.S., but against global capital. The South has the largest concentration of foreign direct investment or global capital investment in the U.S. A number of foreign-owned industries, corporations, auto, electronics, and others exist in the South. Major section of the military-industrial complex, the defense industry, are located in the South. So it's a very important, you know, to understand this region, which has been missing, I think, in terms of how the organization and dominance of capital in the U.S., you know, is looked at, even by the Occupy movement. We'd like to say, I think, that the Occupy movement has been very important. It's help to expose the 1%, the capitalist ruling class, I guess we will call them, in creating the economic and social crisis that's facing the majority. And it offers a real important opportunity to bring forward the demands and movements for economic, social, and cultural rights that reflect the struggles of the most oppressed. And I think it's important to point that out, that the struggle for economic, social, and cultural rights, you know, are anchored by the struggles of the most oppressed, really the national movements inside of the U.S. And largely the history of the African-American struggles and struggles of other oppressed nationalities. The people of color groups that have emerged in the Occupy movement, I think they reflect the coming forward of these demands around economic, social, and cultural rights, but the struggles still remain local. The expressions of national resistance by the most oppressed sectors are still weak, and they're weak because of the fragmentation of the left in these national movements. The left, the black left in the U.S. is fragmented. There's efforts to try to resolve that, but it's fragmented. Therefore, the impact of the black working class nationally as a major social force challenging capital, influencing the character of the fight against the 1% has not yet materialized. A lot of local struggles, but the ability to connect the struggles into real expressions of national resistance, but led by the black working class, is still on the agenda, in our opinion, as a crucial a necessity. We do see, however, that in terms of the Black Workers for Justice, as using this period as an opportunity to raise the level of political consciousness and understanding about the capitalist system in the work of our base. In North Carolina, we probably have about 3,500 members in our union, still a small union, you know, statewide in about 14 institutions, mainly in the public sector, but also in the private sector, largely African American and women make up our union. So raising this consciousness about how the immediate struggles relate to the struggle against the struggle of the 99% against the 1%. Is extremely important for our work. The attacks, you know, on our membership, on the working class, at work and in the communities are increasing. They just, the legislature just, for example, overrode a veto by the governor that winded up eliminating dues checkoff for the teachers. The courts, you know, kind of reversed it, but this is the second time, and so, you know, we see this as an attack on a work organization, despite some of the weaknesses of the trade unions, the attack on the resources, you know, of the work organizations. We think this is a very important period to project what we call social movement unionism, a rank and file, a tendency where the rank and file, you know, are engaged, they build alliances with other sections of the class in the labor movement and other social movements, and they begin to democratize and transform the trade unions from being top-down bureaucratic-led forces to a part of the larger class struggle of the working class. So we think this is a period where that kind of education is important. In North Carolina and the South, where you have a history of right-to-work laws, right of the employer to work the hell out of you and not to be accountable for it, as we characterize it. Many of these laws, for example, emerged during the Jim Crow period. And so we assert that they are still, you know, the unfinished business, you know, of the struggle to resolve that historical contradiction. But again, I would say that what we're not hearing, comrades, you know, is the role of the South. 57% of African Americans in the U.S. now live in the South. Almost half of the U.S. auto industry is now located in the South. Some of the many steel mills are located in the South. The defense industry is located largely in the South, and so we're not hearing the importance of struggling against capital framed in a strategic way. How do we alter the balance of power in favor of the working class struggle against capital? What is the role of the South in doing that? That's been our concentration. One of the weaknesses in the class struggle has been a weakness of organizing the working class in the South. There has to be a strong labor movement. There's obviously been some contradictions that have developed over time, you know, in the U.S. Trade union movement. But the labor movement is extremely important, particularly at the workplace, the point of service, and a point of production. If the working class is not organized there, then we lack a sense, you know, of the power that we really have to really challenge capital, not only domestically but internationally. In North Carolina, for example, labor is only about 3% organized. You know, public sector workers have no collective bargaining rights. In most of the southern states, it's the same way. Right to work has continuously made the South, along with its history of U.S. apartheid, the region where the working class is the most divided. There's tremendous underdevelopment in the South that reflects the deep oppression of the African American people, of Native American sections of the people, and Latinos who are now migrating into the South. So this question of economic, social, and cultural rights, the struggle in the South has a very important role, particularly the working class struggle in the South, has a very, very important role in order to help, you know, to bring that awareness forward. During the time of the Wisconsin struggle, we wanted to figure out how to be able to unite with these struggles. You know, the question of calling for strikes has been very, very difficult for us in the South because of the right-to-work laws, the illegality of them, et cetera. However, there have been strikes. There haven't been national calls for strikes, but in several municipalities where our members are located, in Raleigh and in Greenville, North Carolina, and Durham, North Carolina, these workers have went out on strike, short strikes, one-day strikes. The most recent one was in November the 9th in Greenville. Some of the Occupy forces or were supportive of that. But the initiative really had to come from the workers themselves. One of the concerns that we are beginning to have, and I think it's important to recognize what the nonprofit movements have done to the workers' movement for a long time. There's been a kind of a paternalism that sometimes have discouraged the initiative of the rank and file, and others have come forward, you know, to act on behalf of the rank and file. We want to encourage this rank and file initiative. We want to encourage the self-organization of the working class, and for the rank and file at the workplace to understand its role, both in taking the lead as well as building alliances with sectors, you know, that are not at the workplace. And so in terms of the Occupy movement, which I'm very, very, very appreciative of, and other comrades who I work with are very, very appreciative of, we have to also understand that there's been a kind of left paternalism in relating, you know, to the grassroots movements and into the working class movements. And that becomes a question, you know, for many of us, you know, how do we ensure that we're developing real class, revolutionary, national, and internationalist consciousness of the rank and file, and not necessarily calling on them to be shop troops for tendencies that may not themselves, you know, be based in the rank and file. I think that's a question that I would hope that we can talk about a little. I think my last point is this, you know, maybe I saw in the formulation of this call, you know, about the multinational character of the working class. I don't think that the real multinational character of the working class in resisting capital has yet expressed itself. I think it may be growing. I think certainly African Americans, Latinos, you know, small elements in the trade union movement. But I think it's an error to characterize the Occupy movement, as important as it has been, I want to underscore that, as a reflection of the multinational working class, that is to say, representing a significant layer of white workers. I think, you know, in the comrades' formulation about Bungie in the EGT, I think it's very important to recognize that Local 10, which was critical to bringing representatives of Local 21, I guess it is, ILW 21, into Oakland and helping to begin to promote the need for a coast-wide movement was extremely important. This was a largely black majority local. It has a history of resistance that came to the aid of what has been a very, very conservative white a local in Longview, showing that the black working class was prepared to build a support for a largely white local as an expression of trying to forge working class unity. I don't think had Local 10 not been involved, that the caravan movement, the December 12th a shutdown, that it probably wouldn't have been called, wouldn't have happened. So I think sometimes, you know, we're not looking at this important role that black workers are playing, even though the media will give attention, you know, otherwise. I think that's, they're probably all of the comments that I have. I probably better can respond to some questions. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Saladin. Excuse me, everybody. So we're going to start the question and answer period. I'm going to turn Monica and Mary Ann. I'm going to just make you all live so you can kind of answer directly to anything. But if anyone has any questions, again, you want to press star 1 to get on the queue. And we'll go, we typically have these till about 3:30. So we'll go with a critical number of questions until we get to that point. So, and again, the questions or the comments will be answered in the order that they're received. So star 1 and we can start. Okay, Carol, you have a question?
Yes. This is Carol Erner. Oh.
You're on.
This is Carol Erner of Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. I'm very excited that this call is taking place. Are we going to find out who was on the call? Are the people that signed up for the caucus on the economic, social, and cultural rights? Have they been invited on the call? And are they here?
A few people are here, from what I can see, Carol. The call went out to the entire membership of the network. So it went up pretty far. But there are a few members who are here.
Good.
Yeah. You have any other questions, Carol?
I will in a minute after I think a minute. I thought I particularly appreciated the both of the first two, which were very practical on things that can be done that are nonviolent, but that are definitely challenging the system. And I'm wondering how we can spread these thoughts and ideas into more in the Occupy movement, because I think this is terrific work by these women.
Em and Marianne, any response to that? Thank you, Carol, for that. Monica?
It was difficult for me to hear the last part of what the person was saying, so if it can be repeated.
Just in brief, how do the work that Take Back the Land and Black Orchid Collective are doing, how to take that deeper and further within the Occupy movement and I think the social movement in general in this country?
So one of the ways that we are thinking about doing that, so when we, the movement, Take Back the Land movement, we're creating caucus spaces for different groups that aren't, we are creating caucus spaces for different identity groups. And one of the reasons that we're doing this, because we think one of the ways to do the work that we're doing deeper is to create spaces for impacted communities to lead in a healthy way, in a way that isn't tokenizing it, in a way that is really addressing what their issues are in a way that makes sense for those communities. And so we're creating caucus spaces within Take Back the Land, and we're also in conversation with some of the Occupy folks to use the model that we're developing to create, to use that in occupied spaces, so some of that can happen. And in addition, we are we put forward, as I talked about earlier, what we talk about is a spring action, which is a way for all these different organizations to come together and to develop a similar framework for what we are ultimately fighting for. So even though the work will look different and may happen differently with, in different places with different leadership styles, for us to still be more or less under the same overarching or campaign arc. So making sure that what we are ultimately fighting for or calling for is coming together. So those are some of the ways. And if folks are interested in learning more about the spring action, folks can check out the Take Back the Land website, because we have calls every week about it, so folks can learn more about it.
Mary Ann, you got any thoughts on that or comments on that?
Sure, just a few things. So just briefly, I guess the people that we work with are not identified as nonviolent activists. They respect a diversity of tactics, longer discussion, but I think one of the things we're preparing for now is May 1st, trying to figure out how we're going to engage and what that day should look like. I definitely agree with the third speaker. Occupy is not a reflection of the multinational working class. So trying to bring workers, gatherings or workers' committees, maybe some type of prefiguration of a workers' general assembly, people from different workplaces sending representatives to this general assembly, and taking actions from that workers' assembly or workers' gathering. I don't know if people are familiar with CSOL, Seattle Solidarity Network. They do kind of workplace actions, solidarity, flying pickets at different workplaces. So I guess that's kind of some of the things we're looking at right now. I'm doing working class flyering, trying to reach out to different sectors of the working class that are not involved in Occupy right now.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you. Any other questions? Anyone else want to get in the queue, press star one, and we'll go from there. Again, if anybody has any questions, star one so you can get on the queue. While we're perhaps waiting for folks, just have a question, I think, in general about the kind of the May calls that are going out, including, I'm including that M, the spring call. If folks could just speak a little bit about how some of that is developing, just very briefly, then we can get kind of to the next question, I think, to just give folks kind of a heads up of some coming down. If you don't have to repeat anything that was already said, but if there's some broader initiatives that folks are aware of, including you, Saladin, if folks can kind of speak to that, I think that would be good just to kind of inform people of what's happening.
Hello?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, we can hear you, Saladin.
Oh, okay. Well, there's been discussion, you know, within the Black Left Unity Network, which the Black Workers for Justice is also a part of, you know, as an effort to try to, unite black activists, you know, to be able to do a concentrated effort, you know, in bringing forward the black working class. There's been discussions about a people's primary that would represent a broad mobilization to engage the masses in coming up with a people's mandate that informs our struggles to take back the land, to build workers' power, and to alter the balance of power, at least, you know, in the ongoing fight, you know, to transform society. You know, we see that the two capitalist parties have not been frameworks to develop a people's mandate, and if they claim to have a mandate from the people, they want it to be contained in this narrow corporate control process, and not to inform actions that the people take, you know, fighting around these social, economic, and cultural rights. So there'll probably be we'll be reaching out to people, trying to get a sense of what people, how people see relating to a people's primary if it's launched. You know, what kind of issues, you know, should be put there, you know, in order to develop a people's agenda and people's mandate. But there has not been, particularly for the African American community, there has not been a mandate for change. There's been aspirations for democracy and, you know, real resistance against national oppression, which has led many of us, you know, to just, many of the masses to just embrace the election of Obama, you understand, as the answer. And it was certainly understood, at least from my vantage point, why the masses, you understand, you know, felt a need to support him. However, it's very, very important that the masses have a program. And I think with a program, the masses will not be so easily drawn, you know, into these emotional needs as they were in 2008. So we would see a people's primary encouraging people who were incarcerated, who are disenfranchised, undocumented workers, everybody, you know, to have a voice in shaping this mandate, you know, so that the program that unites the people will be a program that's shaped by the people.
All right, thank you for that, Saladin. We have a question or comment from Afia. We're going to go to Afia now. Afia, you're live.
Okay. First of all, I want to applaud you and the network for having such a powerful program on International Women's Day and headlining women in a substantive way. So big ups to you and the network for that, and deep, deep appreciation to the panelists, and especially the work that the sisters are doing, taking such an aggressive leadership role in addressing the issues that have been so long neglected and so desperately in need of attention. I understand that there have been confrontations with law enforcement and internment of activists in both movements. And my question goes to how have they been able to address that issue, and how have they been able to build the necessary legal support, and whether or not they have come to addressing the issue of jail, no bail, as the next step in their efforts. Thank you.
Thanks, Sophia. Marianne,
there have been multiple people arrested in Seattle. I don't think we have a great solution to it. We're pretty strapped. We have most of the people we work with are unemployed or underemployed. So I really don't think we have we don't have enough resources to address mass arrests. I mean, it's hard. I think some of the early arrests, people got more support, and then and later they really did not. There's just not enough resources to support them financially. Going to all the court dates. We had a lot of people, dozens and dozens and dozens of people arrested. So not as many as Oakland, I should say. Oakland, they've had more. But as far as jail, no bail, I don't think anything like that has developed in Seattle, unfortunately. I think that the arrests were happened in more of a spontaneous way, not as organized as would require for that kind of political character to internal jail resistance. Yeah. Chuck.
Thanks. Monica,
can you repeat the question? I'm picking up a bad echo, so sometimes it's hard for me to hear.
Okay. I believe, in short, just, you know, lessons in how Take Back the Land in various places are responding to police repression and some of the mass arrests that people are taking. You know, how folks dealing with that and what lessons can be learned and shared.
So I think it's different in different places because Take Back the Land is all over. So in Madison, we have not had any arrests. Here, and part of that, at least right now, has been, so Madison, the climate is very hostile towards black folks here, and so if we get arrested, we need to make sure that it's the best time to be strategic about when to take arrests, when it makes the most sense to do it. But in other areas, other places throughout the country, folks have been arrested and it's been used. The police are not generally supportive and arrests have been taken, and it's and that tension has created or has gotten a good amount of leverage. So if we look at the case of Rochester, for example, so in Madison, the people who are organizing here are black, primarily black, with maybe a few non-black allies. And then in Portland, the people who are mainly organizing or doing a lot of the on-ground work are white youth, so that like 20 age range. And I think, and most of them are middle class. But the house or the family that they are working with is a black woman. And so the dynamic of how the police are responding is much different than the folks that we work with here who are homeless, or formerly homeless, low-income black people, whereas the main organizers, they are white, middle-class young folks. But in Rochester, when they wanted to evict the woman from her home, the folks were prepared to defend the house with their bodies, but the police came very strongly. Like, they brought out a SWAT team, and so they came out with, like, full armor, gear, machine guns, and the kids were prepared to do the blockade. But when they saw that, they ran, or they moved at it, which makes complete sense. And so the police come very, very strong. In the case of Miami, the government, when they built the shanty town, the government burned it down. The police burned it down. So the police have been very aggressive, if you will, in trying to put down the fire, so to speak. But in turn, folks have just responded with more organizing. So in the case of Rochester, they just moved her back into the house and did more defenses, and she's still currently there. So,
all right, thanks, Monica. Sorry about that, everybody. I think it's my phone that's causing your static, Monica, unfortunately. But we have time for one last question or comment, so if someone wants to get in on that, please press *1 and we'll take you next. All right. So why don't we do this, and just to close this out, if we can, you know, just any kind of parting thoughts or comments. We want to continue this conversation, I think, in dialogue. I know all three of you raised some critical questions that we only kind of touched the surface on that I think are very, substantive challenges we need to take up in terms of organizing to transform this country. So hopefully we can return to some of that into some further dialogue. But if we can just do some, 1 or 2 minute closeout statements, and we'll go in reverse order. So Saladin, we'll start with you. If anything you want to close out, and if you can, everyone, please be sure to include one last time how folks can get a hold of you and access your information. So Saladin.
Yeah, I really want to appreciate the presentations by the two comrades. Learn quite a bit. I think the question of building a Black left unity or the unity of, of Black activists is very, very critical in this period. This unity is not a narrow unity. It's a unity with an internationalist perspective, but it's a necessary unity in order to bring forward in a massive way a resistance of the Black working class. It's just so vital to helping to accelerate the wider movements, that are taking place today in the country. And we would hope, that the comrades would unite with that view and to encourage, Black activists, to participate in the Black Left Unity Network as an effort to try to bring an expression of real national resistance of the African American people forward as an expression of international solidarity.
All right, Marianne, any closing statements, thoughts?
Sure. Thank you again for letting us speak on the call. It was great hearing what's happening in Madison, what's happening in the South. I just want to echo one thing Saladin said about the Local 10 in Oakland. Definitely the role of Local 10 was essential to everything that's happened in Occupy Oakland and the West Coast solidarity actions. I guess as revolutionaries, we really need a strategy and vision that is effective, is reflective of this moment in time, instead of tailing struggles. And I think that's our task right now is to engage with the Occupy movement, push it forward, and then look for what will happen beyond that. Because as has been said, the Occupy movement doesn't represent the class struggle that needs to happen for revolution. So really looking forward to continuing discussions around unionism, around decolonization, land sovereignty, all those questions. Hopefully we can stay in contact. So thank you.
All right, thank you. So, M, want to close us out?
Mm-hmm. So the way of contacting me is M as in Monica, just the letter M, at takebacktheland.org. And the website is takebacktheland.org if folks are more interested in learning about what we do and also the spring action that we are putting a call out for. And so I think something that's really, really important that's going to make or break what happens here is, one, in what ways are we addressing or grappling with the hard questions of race, class, gender, sexuality, citizenship status, so on and so forth? Because I think the issues look very different in different communities, and I don't necessarily think that the answer is for everybody to stop doing what they're doing and do one thing, but instead to figure out a strategic way for everybody to do the relevant thing, the thing that improves their communities. In a strategic way that comes together. So, for example, if folks are occupying public space, how do we create a platform where we occupy public space as well as take back land and low-income communities of color and shut down banks? And, so how do we do all of that with a concerted effort? And I think it's really important that we have those conversations because we're looking at a broader or a longer protracted struggle, which is what needs to happen in order to win. And just ideas and ways that I have around that. And so I want for these types of conversations to happen more, and then also for people who are in different positions because of privilege to be talking about those who do not have privilege, right? So if a group has the ability and the privilege to shut down Wall Street, right, like that group, I think, also has the responsibility to talk about those who are impacted by Wall Street but could never make it there because of structural oppression. So I think we've got to be doing all of it. I think we need to be clear around what our framework is, what are we ultimately trying to achieve, and what is the role of race, class, gender, so on and so forth in our movement, and how do we leverage that power, right? So those with resources, how do they share those resources and give those resources up to groups to build the communities that that certain movements are not representative of? So it's just my thought.
All right, I want to thank all three of you for taking out the time and putting these presentations together. Much appreciated. We will definitely be kind of continuing on with these discussions and kind of educational presentations throughout the year, looking to tackle some of these questions. So we will definitely stay in touch and hope that all of you join us. Just before everybody leaves, I do want to make a couple of just quick announcements of a couple of things that the network and some of its members will be engaged in over the course of the next several weeks. Number one, there's a strategy for promoting accountability, CLE and workshop session in New York City, March 15th and 16th. For those of you who want to attend that, it's primarily going to be focused on the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and how to use it. This is and some engagement with the actual Human Rights Council itself in regards to addressing questions of the U.S. Human Rights recent report on ICCPR. So that's March 15th and 16th. Right on the heels of that, there's the Left Forum, which is also in New York City, and that's going to be the 16th through the 18th. And the U.S. Human Rights Network is involved. Members of the Coordinating Center, including myself, are involved in several panels at the forum, as well as many of you, and some of you who may not be able to make it. Hopefully most of that will be recorded, but Take Back the Land is engaged in some workshop sessions there. The Black Love Unity Network, Black Workers for Justice, including Saladin and Afia, who's also here, going to be participating in that, so folks can make it out to that. That will be great. And then there's a conference which is going to be taking place in Jackson, Mississippi, April 3rd and 4th, in part in honor of Martin Luther King and the Poor People's Economic Campaign that he was launching. That's entitled Social Justice, Racial Justice, and Economic Development, and that's going to be taking place, and you can find all that information on our website, which is www.ushr.org, ushrnetwork.org, excuse me. And be on the lookout, again, for the statement for International Women's Day and some recent victories and things that are going on that should have just gone out a few minutes ago while we were on the call. And just like to thank all of you again for joining us and be looking forward to dialogue and communicating with you all soon. And with that, just want to say thank you to everybody, and we will be in touch down the road. Take care.
All right.